The post office breathed in sighs. Not the clean exhalation of a bell tower or the sharp crack of a cannon, though Concetta knew both sounds well enough, having heard the bell every Sunday for 43 years and the cannon once, from the harbor wall, when she was a girl, and the men had gone to fight. This was something quieter. The building itself seemed to exhale whenever the door opened, and the sea air slipped inside, carrying with it the salt and the damp and the faint rot of kelp left too long on the stones. The air in La Posta was always thick, even in winter. Dust motes danced in whatever light managed through the high windows, swirling above the sorting tables like tiny, frantic things that had nowhere else to be. Concetta arrived before anyone else. She always did. It was not devotion that brought her early, it was habit, deep set and rigid as the grain in a workbench. She unlocked the door at 7:30, though the mail truck did not come until 8. She locked it again behind her, turned the key twice, and walked to the back room where the unsorted piles waited. The smell hit her first. Damp paper and stale tobacco, the particular stench of letters that had traveled through other people's pockets, other people's hands. She lit the stove and set the kettle on top, then began to sort. The brass scales on the counter were tarnished to a dull, muddy brown, their pans frozen in an uneven tilt that had not shifted in years. Dust did not settle here. It accumulated in thick, gray felt along the edges of the counter and inside the cracks of the floorboards, undisturbed by footfall or breeze. The air hung heavy and still, pressing against the skin like a wet wool blanket. Outside, the world moved with the hurried pace of the morning commute, but inside, time seemed to have curdled, leaving everything suspended in a state of quiet decay. The kettle whistled. She poured the water over the tea bag, watched the color bloom, and carried the cup back to the sorting table. She took one sip and set it down beside a stack of envelopes that had come from the capital. These were heavier, thicker, the kind of mail that belonged to people who had somewhere else to be. Then she saw it. It was wedged between a bill from the electricity company and a circular from the Ministry of Agriculture about crop rotation. The envelope was pale blue, the color of a sky that had been washed too many times, and it bore no stamp. Instead, a small wax seal, the kind she had only ever seen on official documents, the kind that made her think of notaries and lawyers and men in suits who smelled of cologne and authority, held the flap closed. She picked it up. The paper was thick, expensive, the sort that cost more than what the postage would have been if someone had bothered to buy a stamp. The address label was stark against the pale blue surface, the ink deliberate and careful, Andrea Marino, deceased. She blinked, assuming a typo, but the word beneath the name was unmistakable. Her thumb found the wax seal and broke it with a soft crack that sounded louder than it should have in the empty room. Inside was a single sheet of folded paper. She unfolded it slowly and set it beside the envelope, her eyes drifting back to the label one more time before she forced herself to look away. Marino, Enzo, deceased, Mason Carré, Marseille, she read it once. Then she read it again. Then she set the envelope down very carefully, as though it might dissolve beneath her fingers, and read it a third time. She stared at the words. The kitchen clock on the wall ticked. Somewhere outside, a dog barked. The dust motes continued their indifferent dance. Andrea Marino was dead. She had buried him. She had lived 2 years of silence since the burial, 2 years of waking beside a bed that was only half a bed, 2 years of teaching his sons to fill the space he had left without mentioning it, without naming it, without letting it become a thing that sat at the table like a guest. And now this letter was addressed to him, from Marseille, postmarked 3 weeks ago. She turned the envelope over. On the back, in handwriting that was neat and unfamiliar, someone had written, "Poor Andrea Marino, il sait où se trouve." He knows where to find himself. Concetta did not know what that meant. She folded the letter back into its envelope and placed it on the far edge of the sorting table, away from the rest, as though distance might protect her from whatever was inside. She told herself she would deal with it later. She told herself it was a mistake, a clerical error, perhaps, or a cruel joke played by someone who knew about the burial and wanted to wound her through the mail. She told herself many things, all of them fragile and all of them false, because the truth was sitting on the table in front of her, and she was afraid to touch it again. At 8:30, the mail truck arrived. Concetta was already at the door, her hands empty, her face composed. The driver, a young man from the next village over, nodded at her without stopping. He never stopped. He threw the sacks onto the pavement, counted them aloud 3, 4, 5, and drove on, his engine coughing smoke into the morning air. Concetta reached for the nearest sack, her fingers brushing the rough twine. She paused, breath catching in her throat, before dragging it across the threshold. Inside, she appended the bundle. Papers cascaded onto the table in a scattered fanbills, invitations, faded postcards. Her hand hovered over the pile, trembling slightly, before she forced it down to separate the stack. Right, left, center, right, left, center. The blue envelope sat on the far edge, untouched. By 10 o'clock, the first customer arrived. Signora Ferrara, who wanted to send a parcel to her daughter in Rome. Concetta waited on the brass scales, calculated the postage, wrapped it in brown paper and string. She spoke in monosyllables, her gaze fixed on the counter's scarred wood, avoiding the woman's eyes as she always did. Signora Ferrara noticed, as everyone did, and said nothing, as everyone did. They all noticed. They all said nothing. That was the arrangement. At 11, Concetta locked the front door and returned to the back room. She sat at the sorting table. The blue envelope was still there, exactly where she had left it. She picked it up and opened it again. The letter inside was written in French. Concetta could read it she had learned in school, the way all children had learned French, before the war had made it a language of enemies and then a language of nothing at all. The handwriting was elegant, the loops of the cursive precise, the ink a deep brown that had bled slightly into the paper, as though the writer had pressed too hard or the pen had been running dry. She read the first line and felt the floor tilt beneath her. Mon cher Andrea, I hope this letter finds you well. I do not know if you will ever receive it, I do not even know if you are still there, but I must write, because the silence has become unbearable, and you are the only one who understands what it means to carry a name that does not belong to you. Concetta put the letter down. She put her head in her hands. She counted to 10. She counted again. When she lifted her head, the letter was still there, and the words were still the same, and the postmark still read Marseille, and the date still said 14 September 1950. 15 years from now. She stared at the date until the numbers blurred. 15 years from now. Andrea was dead. He had been dead since October 1943, when the ship went down in the channel and the sea took him without ceremony. There was a stone in the cemetery with his name on it. There was a black ribbon on the doorframe. There were two sons who called another man their father and did not know the difference. There was this letter. Concetta folded it carefully and placed it back in the envelope. She walked to the filing cabinet in the corner of the room, the one marked defunts in faded lettering, the one where she kept the letters that arrived for dead men and dead women, the ones she stacked in a drawer and pretended not to see. She opened the drawer. It was full. It was always full. Dead men kept receiving mail because the world did not know how to stop writing to them, because grief had a long tail and bureaucracy had no memory. She placed the blue envelope at the front of the drawer, on top of everything else, where she would not be able to ignore it tomorrow morning, where she would have to decide what to do with it. She closed the drawer. She locked it. She walked to the window and looked out at the street, at the sea beyond it, at the sky that was the color of washed-out denim and stretched itself endlessly overhead. The dust motes had settled, the room was quiet, the kettle had gone cold. She thought about burning the letter. She thought about taking it to Padre Salvatore and asking him what it meant. She thought about showing it to Enzo and watching his face change, watching the way he would look at her the way he always looked at her when she said something dangerous, with a mixture of fear and something that might have been anger, might have been love, might have been both. Instead, she did nothing. She stood at the window until the light changed. She thought about Andrea. She thought about Marseille. She thought about the date, which was impossible, which was impossible, which was impossible. Then she washed the teacup, wiped down the sorting table, and went home. The envelope sat on the sorting table like a mistake. Concetta stared at it for a long time, her hands hovering above the paper but not touching. The morning light from the high window cut across the room in dusty shafts, illuminating the motes that drifted through the stale tobacco air. La Posta breathed around her the same quiet sighing sound it made every day, but the silence here, at this specific square inch of scarred wood, felt heavier. Different. She had sorted 3 sacks already. Signora Bellini's bills, the quarterly tax notice for the fishmonger, a postcard from Rome that belonged to the vicar's cousin. Right, left, center. Letters right, parcels left, postcard center. 43 years of the bell, 43 years of knowing exactly where things belonged. But this letter did not belong anywhere. The address was written in ink that had bled slightly into the paper, the loops of the cursive curling with an elegance that made Concetta's throat tighten. Andrea Marino. Below it, in smaller, tighter script, deceased. And below that, the return address she had already memorized from the first reading, though she had told herself she would not look again. Rue Paradis, Marseille. Her fingers finally moved. They trembled, just barely a slight vibration she hid by pressing her palms flat against the table edge for a moment before picking up the envelope. The paper was thick, expensive. The kind of stationery Andrea had never bought in his life. He wrote on the backs of envelopes, on scrap paper, on the margins of newspaper clippings. He wrote quickly, impatiently, the way a man speaks when he knows the conversation won't last. This handwriting was careful, measured. It was not Andrea's. Have to. She repeated the words the way she repeated them at the post office flat, neutral, stripping them of meaning until they were just sounds. Like the mail truck, like the bell, like something that arrives whether you want it or not. He turned then. In the dark, she could only see the outline of his face, the angle of his jaw, the way his mouth pulled tight at the corners. He looked older than he had in the morning, older than he had yesterday. Concetta. Don't. She set the glass down on the terrace railing. It made a small sound against the stone, barely audible over the dog, over the sea, over the blood rushing in her ears. Don't say my name like you're already saying goodbye. I haven't given you permission for that part. He stood. The chair scraped against the stone. He was taller than her by a head, but in that moment, he seemed smaller folded inward, shoulders hunched as though carrying something heavier than his body. He took one step toward her, then stopped. She wondered if he was afraid of touching her. She wondered if she was afraid of being touched. The dog stopped barking. The silence that followed was worse. I'll come back, he said. She had heard this sentence before, from other men, in other summers. The fishermen who left for the seasonal runs and returned with salt in their hair and money in their pockets and stories they wouldn't tell. The young men who volunteered for the army and wrote letters that grew shorter each month until the letters stopped altogether. She had sorted all of them at the post office. She had held all of them in her hands. She knew the weight of a promise the way she knew the weight of paper. What's your word? She asked. He hesitated. This was the wrong answer. She knew it before he did. His hesitation was a door closing. I don't know, he said. The words landed between them like stones dropped into still water. She watched the ripples spread across the terrace, across the space where they had stood close enough to share warmth, close enough to hear each other breathe. That's not a word, she said. That's a confession. She went back inside. She closed the door behind her and did not lock it, because locking it would mean admitting that she expected him to leave. She stood in the kitchen and watched the oregano leaves trembling in the hot air, their edges curling brown at the tips. She thought about putting the kettle on again, but the thought exhausted her. She thought about calling out to him, asking him to stay one more night, one more hour, one more minute. She thought about it the way she thought about the impossible dates in the letters, knowing they were wrong, knowing she should stop thinking about them, knowing she would think about them anyway. In the morning, she woke alone. The bed was cold on his side, the sheets pulled taut as though someone had smoothed them with angry hands. She lay there for a long time, listening to the village wake the shutters banging, the rooster crowing, the distant thud of Enzo's boat engine as he headed out to sea. Enzo, who had been kind when Andrea left, who had brought her a pot of soup and stayed for 10 minutes and said very little and meant every word. Enzo, who had taken her in the way a man takes on extra weight without complaining, without asking for thanks, without making it a thing. She got up and dressed and went downstairs. Nana Rosa was already at the table, eating bread dipped in olive oil, her eyes clouded but sharp, tracking Concetta's movements like a bird tracking a snake. He's gone, Nana Rosa said. It wasn't a question. Concetta didn't answer. She poured coffee and stood at the sink, watching the dark liquid fill the cup. Good, Nana Rosa said. He should have gone years ago. A man who runs is a man who knows he's guilty of something. You should be glad he didn't take you with him. The words were a blade, wrapped in silk, delivered with a smile. Concetta felt the cut anyway. She turned from the sink and walked out of the kitchen, leaving the coffee unfinished, leaving Nana Rosa to her bread and her bitterness and her perfect, preserved memory of a son who would never disappoint her. By noon, Andrea had packed everything into two leather trunks and a canvas bag. He worked methodically, the way he worked at everything carefully, precisely, as though precision could substitute for feeling. He folded shirts. He stacked books. He placed his shaving kit in the canvas bag with the exact order she recognized from their life together: razor on top, soap beneath, the small tin of cream that she bought for him every Christmas. She stood in the doorway and watched him. She wanted to say something. She wanted to say, "Stop, please stop. I will be reasonable. I will not cry. I will not beg. Just stop." But the words sat in her throat like swallowed glass, and she swallowed harder and said nothing. When he zipped the last trunk, the sound was final. It was the sound of a drawer closing in a morgue. It was the sound of a letter being sealed and stamped and sent away. "I'll write," he said. She had asked him this already in the dark, and he had not answered. Now he offered it freely, like a man offering a coin to a beggar. "How often?" "Whenever I can." "That's not an answer." He looked at her, then really looked at her, and for a moment she saw something in his eyes that wasn't fear or guilt or the rehearsed flatness she had seen the night before. It was hunger. It was the same hunger she had seen the first time they met, at the festival in August, when he was younger and the war hadn't yet taken everything from him. His gaze fixed on her lips, sharp and unblinking, stripping away the courtesy of years. It was the look of a man who knew the door was locked, yet still reached for the handle. Then the moment passed. He looked away. He picked up the trunks. At the door, he paused. The canvas bag hung from his shoulder, the trunks in his hands. Sunlight fell across the threshold, dividing the house into light and shadow, and he stood on the wrong side of it. "Concetta." She said nothing. "If I don't come back." "Then I'll sort your mail," she said. "I'll put it in a pile. I'll keep it on the shelf behind the postcards. And one day, when I'm dead and the village forgets your name, they'll find it and they'll wonder why a dead man kept writing to a ghost." He flinched. She saw it, a small movement, a tightening around the eyes, a breath caught and released. It was the closest thing to regret she would get from him. It was not enough. It was everything. He stepped into the light. The door closed behind him. She heard his footsteps on the stone street, fading, fading, until they were gone, and the only sound was the sea and the oregano leaves trembling in the hot air, and the silence that followed a man who had not given her his word. She stood in the doorway for a long time. Then she went back inside and sat at the sorting table and arranged the afternoon's letters into their proper places, right, left, center, and she did it with such precision that her hands shook only once, and she pressed them flat against the wood and waited for the shaking to stop. The silence remained, heavy and absolute, settling over the room like dust.